disaster. Don't you give up, don't you let away. Talking about a forever after. Don't you give up, don't you dare.
Don't you give up, don't you dare give in. And boy, is it precarious out there. It's getting more precarious and hot and challenging by the day. And today, this is Jack Tuckner, by the way, welcoming you, my friends, brothers and sisters, clients, family and allies, to the Women's Rights in the Workplace Sanctuary on the Progressive Internet Radio Network for the sane among us, PRN.FM. I was starting to say that just today, what is it? It is June 30th, 2014, our irreverent and misguided and corrupt highest court in the land issued and two new decisions that should frighten and mortify all of us. And we'll probably talk about that during this time. And welcome to our Title IX show. Very important if you think that Title IX, and I'll explain why, is very important meme that's been sort of traveling around the internet at warp speed as a result of recent events. But Title IX, most people, if they know anything at all about the law known as Title IX, think of it as that's that girl sports law, right? It requires colleges and high schools to make sure girls or young women have access to sporting, access to teams and clubs and so forth, equivalent to what men have always had, except that's really only one tiny part of it, and much of its power is in what most people don't know about. So what we're talking about today is the next generation of Title IX. It's how Title IX can and should be used to prevent sexual harassment, sexual abuse, and bullying based on sex in educational settings, and how you can use Title IX to empower yourself and to change your school environment. In fact, it's so bad in most universities to just today again in Huffington Post, there was another report that now over 60 universities, many of them the top Ivy League institutions, are out of compliance with Title IX, meaning they have messed up in one way or another allegations of sexual abuse, rape in some cases on campus, sexual harassment, and sex discrimination, either in its process in trying to redress these issues or in its reporting. But the numbers are sort of staggering and have really give us pause that something needs to be done. But today, I am going to explain to you all about Title IX. So that by the end of this show, and you know what, if you have a child that is approaching high school or college age, if you yourself, male or female, are about to embark on secondary education or college, I think it's really important. It's important that we all know, because raising awareness is really what makes the it's not the law itself. The law itself is a very blunt tool, very challenging, very difficult to actually use Title IX. It's not like, oh, I'm just going to sue you in federal court under Title IX. Good luck with that. And the damages, what lawyers talk about, what you can get as a result of a lawsuit, you got to jump through so many hoops. It's so difficult. I don't wish that upon anyone. The import of Title IX is that if we raise awareness that there is a law that requires institutions to treat women equally and give women access to higher education, whether it's academic or in sporting events, or to not to be free of fear, free of hostility in the war, in the school environment on the basis of sex, gender, gender conformity, same-sex harassment, it's all covered by Title IX. So no one's very underreported. No one really talks about, which is why so many schools are out of compliance, how Title IX, apart from athletics, it's not even mentioned in the statute. There's no discussion in Title IX, all of 37 words that we'll discuss in a moment. There's no reference to sports. It's about access. So I will, as I said, using my best Ricky Ricardo imitation is the only word I remember from that show. I will explain it all to you, and it won't be mansplaining. Trust me, as I wouldn't dare to think I know what's best for women if and when women don't actually feel that way themselves. The fact is, I am a middle-aged, cisgender white male, and I realize the many privileges I enjoy in this sexist and racist rape culture that we all live in. And I use the term rape culture broadly, including our Wall Street bankster culture, as part of the entire broad, dysfunctional, patriarchal paradigm that we all find ourselves in that nourishes and feeds into the rape culture that tends to, among many other things, disenfranchise and disempower women, among other minority groups that are not white males of a certain income level, typically. So, if you don't know what Title IX is, or if you think it's just as one of my colleagues and friends said the other day, isn't that and he's a lawyer, isn't that law that just supports, chicks in sports? No, that's not it. It's what you're thinking it is, and it does, in fact, it is the law that changed everything in 1972. I mean, everything. It's one of the most important civil rights laws that most people don't know about that's been enacted in the last 50 years. In fact, it was its 42nd birthday on June 23rd of this year. So it should be a concern to all of us really understand the power and the typical sort of disuse of Title IX, because it's not just about women's sports. In fact, it never was. It's about baseline equality, opportunity, and access to all things educational. And why should a guy, why should a man care about women's issues enough to speak publicly about them without resorting to condescending, basically misogynism in disguise, mansplaining? Well, I always counter that question and that argument with, how can men not care about women's issues? How can men not be feminists? As, first of all, the issues that undergird feminism, sexism, rampant sexism in our patriarchal rape culture is inextricably linked with everything else. Sexism, that is, to the rest of our sort of male ego poisoned, outrageously dysfunctional, unequal, unfair, gun ridden culture of violence and wealth inequality, constant warfare, imperialism, the full hollowing out of the American middle class. But more important than that, because it's all again tied to the repression, the suppression, the marginalization, the second class citizenship of, and the way we always like to sort of sexualize and objectify women in our culture. But I have another question about this. I don't understand if you as a man, or as a woman, but it seems to be easier when we're talking about, if you're a woman yourself, we understand why you have an interest in women's empowerment, which was why around the time of the 2012 election, if you recall, there was a photograph that was traveling around Facebook and the internet that showed a picture of a woman sitting in a chair punching herself in the face. And the caption was something to the effect of, this is what it means when women vote Republican, that it's simply obviously voting against your interests. But for men, if you have a woman or women in your life that you love like a madman? Well, I certainly do. And I never understood the sort of simplistic, reductionist, I'm a boy, I'm white, so I can't relate. Now, maybe I'm a little crazy, I concede that, and I love the women in my life. And when I'm thinking about in terms of my daughters that are in their 20s, and again, forget about me. If you have a sister, wife, daughter, mother, grandmother, girlfriend, anyone who's female who you're fond of, don't you care that they have full opportunities for wellness and happiness? Don't you want the girls and women in your life to be healthy and have a strong body and a strong mind? Don't you want them to have opportunities for success and happiness and independence? Hello? Now, our Supreme Court, by the way, the Supreme Court of the United States doesn't care about women, that's for sure. I mean, just today, the five angry, crazy old men who make up the majority of the United States Supreme Court, these regressive, mean-spirited, corrupt, misogynistic, misguided, and deeply flawed, wacky old reactionary men, and these are the top lawyers and the top judges in our country. They just decided today, June 30th, in the 5-4 decision, it's always those five right-wing wackadoodles that decide all decisions against people, women, people of color, any, you know, the LGBTQ community, any, all of us, the 99% really, except for corporations and this very wealthy and the police state. The court doesn't care about people or the planet for that matter. But the decision today was that a private employer that professes to be religious, quote unquote, not the original religion, whatever the religion is that implies and means and should mean, I'm sure we all would all agree, love, unity, oneness, compassion, forgiveness for all living things, never mind your fellow human beings. But this stern, punitive, hateful, excluding, sex-negative, stingy, sociopathic religion of today's know-nothing reactionary teabagging Republican Party, who don't give a rat's patootie for people or the planet that we live on. And they decided just today that a private employer can refuse to pay for women's reproductive health needs, such as for birth control. A completely medieval decision right out of a 14th century star chamber. But then they also today did away with public union bargaining rights, so we'll all have the freedom, or we're starting down the road towards the freedom to work for less, the freedom to live under a bridge. You know, freedom. That's what the sort of the right wants us to accomplish as we trend downward into the third world plutocracy that we're surely becoming. But so there's a long line of cases since this, you know, the Supreme Court majority became so right-wing that hurt us, that hurt our country, that hurt our planet, all unfair and corrupt, all starting with going back decades. But look, Bush v. Gore, it all matters. It's why it matters who the president is, because the president of the United States gets to nominate the Supreme Court justices, and they've turned themselves into nine monarchs, basically. They've given themselves the power to create and make law, which was never enshrined, embodied in the Constitution. And this particular bunch are bought and paid for, basically, by the same sort of climate-denying Republicans who will take us quickly down the path to ruin. So it's a matter, it's a very important who our president is, because I don't think, you know, democracy is not a spectator sport. We all have to get involved. And if the next president gets to choose more so-called conservative, they don't conserve anything but conservatives as opposed to, you know, right-thinking, seek justice, open-minded, progressive, actually fair-thinking judges and lawyers, it's all going to get that much worse for all of us. But, you know, enough of that rant. I just, you know, we're in the predicament we're in because these days, or over the last 30-odd years, because of this right-wing corporate counter-revolution that started with Ronald Reagan, that has basically divested all of us of the democracy that we thought we live in. And, you know, the very wealthy are doing very well, thank you very much, but the rest of us are not. And I'm going to get back to today what I'm here to talk about, which is Title IX. Sorry about that rant. So Title IX, let me tell you what Title IX is all about. That's the name of the statute that was enacted, signed into law by President Nixon. Yes, he did. June 23rd, 1972. And prior to the enactment of Title IX. Women, first of all, before 1972, women with college degrees were 8% of the female population of that age demographic, up today to, I think, something like 60% or higher. I don't recall offhand, but it was barely, it was a single digits. And today, the majority of entering freshmen into colleges is from 56 to 59% female. So, huge difference. It used to be considered that women were going to college, and this wasn't very long ago. I mean, it's in my lifetime. I was in college then. Before 72, it was assumed that women were pursuing their Mrs. degree, that they were attending college to find a husband. And they would attend grad school to find an even better off husband. And eventually they would get married and have children and not work. So why give up a college seat, if you will, to a woman when it could be better used by a real student on his way to make money and get a job? A boy, a man. So women did not have equal access or any regulation or law that would require a college or a grad school. In fact, law schools and medical schools before 1972 had quotas. I mean, how many girls can you take? They shouldn't be, you know, the delicate, the weaker sex, so-called, shouldn't be in these professions, certainly not lawyers and doctors and engineers, which we're still having significant problems with, all the so-called STEM field sciences and pursuits and so forth, and engineering and math. So what the statute did was give access. It was not about sports, although it was wonderful that that was one of the side effects, because it meant that finally girls who typically after sixth grade stopped being given access to any type of organized sport activity, even in high school, except for maybe jumping rope. There was a physician whose name escapes me now, also not long ago, who hypothesized that any kind of physical activity would sort of damage the delicate constitution of women. So women did not have the ability to play sports and didn't have access to education until, again, 1972. So it's important to note that there were three progressive, one senator named Birch Bayh, who was actually a great man, whose own wife, who was a brilliant student who couldn't gain entry to the University of Virginia because they didn't accept women back then. And she told him, hey, 53% of our population is not getting to use their brain or body. That's not fair. That's not right. And the original, you know, sort of godmother law, the Equal Rights Amendment that for what now, 80 years has been sort of languishing and never gets passed, the Equal Rights Amendment that was designed to just at least symbolically, if for nothing else, to give sort of the full rights of citizenship to women. And now we haven't passed the Equal Rights Amendment yet, but we have corporations that have been deemed persons by the Supreme Court. They haven't recognized women specifically, but now corporations are persons and money is speech, which is a major, major, you know, travesty of a decision that is leading us down this garden path to ruin. But perhaps a little more on that later. I just wanted to point out that Birch Bayh and there were two congresswomen, Patsy Mink, who's now deceased, and Edith Green, that were the champions of Title IX. And it was, again, it's all of 37 words. You could tweet it three times and have room for numerous hashtags. In fact, I wanted to just play for you something that the White House, this was last year, and let me see if I have this queued up properly here. Well, let me just start this again.
June 23rd, 1972 is an important day in the history of this country because of that breakthrough legislation which was passed, which really provided opportunities for women and girls that they had never had before in the history of this country.
Now, that was Kathleen Sebelius, the former Health and Human Services chair. I don't recall the title, and you know, a cabinet member who just read Title IX. Here's what Title IX says. No person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Again, no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. They all receive federal financial assistance, essentially. So every school, virtually every institution, is covered. How does this law, which of course doesn't mention sports, and it's became synonymous with women in sport collegiately, how does this law protect women from sexual abuse, sexual harassment, and sex discrimination, which much of the time, most people, most students, most families are not aware of that? And we will get to that shortly. Let me just let them continue speaking for themselves.
The law is only 37 words, as I recall, but it has a big punch. Title IX is designed to provide equality of opportunity for young women. Now, that was not the case before Title IX.
Senator Birchbach.
I graduated from college before Title IX passed, but my entire school experience was at a girls' school in high school and in college. So I was one of the few women my age who actually could play sports.
Kathleen Sebelius again.
Schools and private schools had sports activities. Public schools and parochial schools didn't. They just stopped. So when I got to college, I learned how many girls my age had come out of a high school experience where, starting in about the sixth or seventh grade, sports just stopped. It didn't matter if they had talent or interest, they just weren't opportunities.
It's amazing, the change because of Title IX. And, you know, it was just...
this is Pat Summitt, a Hall of Fame basketball coach.
I was able to see that and to understand how many people were going to benefit because of Title IX.
I think it really did make a huge, huge difference. We had kind of a joke in my family because I actually won the Teddy Roosevelt NCAA award for being a scholar athlete. That was in the days when there were no girls' varsity sports. And, you know, so how I managed to get that award is beyond me. But the bottom line is it made a huge, huge difference in terms of the way that girls and women see each other as capable of competing on an equal field and winning.
Madeline Albright.
My first goal was to play in the NBA.
And this is Tamika Catchings, a professional basketball player.
I worked and I was like determined to be a player in the NBA and following my father's footsteps. And then the WNBA came around my freshman year in college at the University of Tennessee, and my goals switched, and it was kind of like a dream come true, you know, just having the opportunity to not play with the NBA where I started, but wanting to play in the WNBA with ladies that have the same dreams and the same goals as me.
Everything's accepted now for women in athletics.
Not quite.
And I think Title IX was a big part of that. And I know just as long as I've been coaching, just once Title IX came around, it just opened doors for so many people, and not just in basketball.
When I first got interested in this
Birchbach.
Equal Rights Amendment, which was sort of the grandfather of Title IX, my late wife said, well, Birch, you can't ignore the brain power for 53% of the American people. We tend to think of Title IX when we look at the sports pages. But when you really look at Title IX, the big benefit from Title IX comes from young women having the opportunity academically to learn.
The fact that we're sitting here brother. Today in 2012 with over half of the college students are women, Over half of the graduate students in all kinds of fields are women. And the notion that, you know, one of the fastest growing segments of our economy are women-owned businesses. We know that opening the doors for women to be in science and technology and engineering are hugely important, not just for the advancement of those women and their families, but for this country, to lift up over half of our population and make sure that we are fully productive and fully prosperous in the future means empowering women and girls, and Title IX took a huge step in that direction.
Can you imagine?
Well, I believe it was so monumental when it was passed, just because, you know, obviously the opportunity that it has afforded all of us. And, you know, when I think about what I'm able to do now and playing in the WNBA and being able to be such a huge role model for so many young girls, I think of all the people that came before us, and not just women, but even the men that, you know, helped in passing this law and in making it that important that girls get the same opportunity that men get.
I think it's probably exceeded the expectations, because we didn't fully realize the degree of discrimination that was going on at the time. We've arrived. When you ask young women in high school, and really in some of our college and universities, did Title IX help you? And you get a blank stare. What's Title IX? They don't think they're getting special treatment. And they aren't. They're being treated equally the way they should have been in the first place. Title IX made that possible.
That was a White House .gov production, and the last person you heard speaking again was the former senator, still alive, 84 years old, the great Birch Bayh of Indiana, who said, as he closed this little piece on Title IX, that today when they go to schools and ask women, did Title IX help you, and they get blank stares because they've never heard of it, and they don't understand, they don't think they're getting special treatment, because they're not. They're being treated equally for the most part, as they should have been to begin with. And again, the law is only 42 years old, and it's taken, certainly for the first decade, no one even had heard of it, and there was, you know, no enforcement at all. And what we'll be getting to in a little while is how it's being used today in the culture. And many of us have seen with the, you know, with hashtag Yes All Women, the idea that has sort of come out of this, you know, the recent Isla Vista slayings in California, where the Yes All Women hashtag has gone viral because it catalyzed something important, something in our culture that needs to be addressed in terms of how we collectively and individually treat the female gender. So Title IX is extremely powerful, and it's just now the awareness on campuses, that, and it's just really in its, somewhat in its infancy. There are many undergraduates, because we see them in our women's rights in the workplace law firm. They come to intern for us, and some of them have only a very vague understanding of Title IX and how it protects them and what it actually stands for and means. So I wanted to just address briefly, there is a lot of, you know, every year Title IX has a birthday, and every year there is detractors who say it's hurting men's sports, and it's a zero-sum game. You give to women, who wear women in water polo, and then you have to get rid of a men's team. Total, complete nonsense. First of all, you know, it's like similar to the men's rights movement, or I guess for that matter, the white rights movement, or white power, whatever it's called these days. Whiny, privileged folks seeking cover for their biases and inadequacies. It's nonsense. You have to give a fair shake to women. This is, you know, that men, and that you hear this everywhere, every year. Oh, they got rid of the wrestling team. It's the girls' fault. It's complete nonsense, because it's similar. You know what it's similar to? It's like our current austerity dilemma. You know, we have no money. We can't pay for the things that we as a society want and need. Austerity for whom? We don't have money for unemployment benefits. We don't have money for health care for everyone, like every other civilized, industrialized nation on the planet. We don't have money to build our bridges, our roads, our rail beds, our dams, the whole crumbling infrastructure because why? Well, first, it's all leaving the country, lining the pockets of the super rich. You know, I spoke recently on a show that about the 42 hedge fund managers who averaged in 2011 $2 billion a year each, $2 billion a year each, which is roughly $1 million an hour. Yes, that's $1 million an hour on a 40-hour work week, because most of us can't really fathom what that means in terms of billions. And they have a 15% tax rate compared perhaps to you or me with a more than double that tax rate in a much, much more modest income. So, and 25% of corporations paying no federal income taxes, the money stashed away in Swiss banks, in the Cayman Islands, offshoring, outsourcing, 65,000 factories closed since the Bush years. 65,000 factories, that's not jobs. Those are factories, done, jobs gone, good jobs, at one point union jobs, not anymore. In fact, today, another Supreme Court case that again whittled away, just today, at the collective bargaining rights of public employees, which is, again, where this court and this country and the right wing want to take us back to your right, your absolute right to work for $3 an hour, your absolute right to put your kid to work if he's 12 years old for $2 an hour. That's freedom, according to the Supreme Court and their enablers. So, you know, between free trade and the fact that, you know, stockholders, if you make a put 65,000 factories in Bangladesh, you could pay 22 cents an hour. Of course, it has nothing to do with our country. You want to be a rich man in a poor country, these guys, these CEOs want to be. That's, you know, but, you know, they're sociopaths. The rest of us can insist on a certain amount of fairness, can insist on protectionism, can insist on things being made in America, can insist on putting us back to work so that we have a middle class again, not one that's being utterly hollowed out when you can't. Do you know of anyone, except for the rare few, perhaps, that can get a job, you know, a job? And I used to, when I was growing up, my friend's dad worked in, as I recall, a tool and die shop for years. They went on family vacations. They had a new car every few years. The fact his mother was a stay-at-home mom. He put a couple of kids, he was put through college by this father, a good, solid, union, blue-collar, so-called job. Where are they now? They're gone. They're not here anymore. So, you know, the bankster stole it all. The financialization of everything in the last few years into bogus, toxic derivatives that only produce revenue for the economic royalists. They capitalize the profits. They externalize and socialize the cost and the damage. They repeal the recent repeal of Glass-Steagall that turned our banks into casinos. You know, I just, the rise of Taibbi, you know, the vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity. The Coke-tapus, you know, the Koch brothers now and their, you know, their long arm that their many, many billions can buy politicians. This all began in earnest, by the way, when Ronald Reagan initiated his corporate counter-revolution in 1980 with the great scam, the great, great scam of trickle-down or supply-side economics. Head, we win. Tails, you lose. And, you know, unregulated capitalism is not what Jefferson and the Founding Fathers had in mind, I dare say. And all of this skullduggery went on steroids when the Supreme Court, just a couple of years ago, in Citizens United, that decision, when they said outrageously that corporations are people and money is speech. So domestic and foreign transnational corporations and billionaires can now buy politicians. I mean, this isn't news to anyone, is it? Through the 37,000 lobbyists that are now in Washington. Used to be around the time of Reagan when he took office in 1980, 81. 200 some odd lobbyists. Now there are 37,000 earning a minimum of $250,000 a year, up to several million dollars when they come out of Congress and become lobbyists themselves because of all the juice they now have. So, and of course, that influences the course of democracy. It's really dark, really gloomy out there. It's truly precarious, as Blues Traveler says at the beginning and end of this show. and don't even get me started on climate change and the relatively imminent death of our planet and species due to greed, myopia, and in my view, sociopathology. So anyway, back from this rant to Title IX, there's plenty of money for men's and women's sports. It's just that in sports, the Big Six get it all. The Division I men's NCAA football and basketball teams get private jets, lavish stadiums, professional equipment, hotel rooms, $500,000 a year coaching salaries. So it ends up being the lesser men's sports that take a hit when there's limited resources. Title IX ain't got nothing to do with it. In fact, I want to play you. Don't take it from me. I have a couple of minutes here. I have a conference from last year. This is, let me just get it up here and see if I can cue this up quickly. This is, let me get it to the part I need to get it with. Donna, I think it's, let me just hold on one second, please, and I will tell you. This is Ms. Lopiano. Donna Lopiano, I believe, is her name. She was the chief executive officer of the Women's Sports Foundation from 1992 to 2007. She was recently named one of the 10 most powerful women in sports by Fox Sports, the Sporting News. She's listed as the 100 most influential people in sports, etc. Former collegiate athlete and activist, and very well versed in all things Title IX. She spoke at this Perspectives on Gender in Sports in the New Millennium Conference in 2013. And had a, which you won't be able to see right now, but, and I'm only giving you just a snippet of this, a slide presentation, which just shows that it's, again, pure bogusness and bogosity. There is no diminution of men's sports due to women's sports, and women are still way behind. Women are now where men were, still not where men were in 1972 in terms of their involvement. So here's Donna Lopiano.
Total student body, 57% of all college students are female. 57%. We only get 43% of all participation opportunities. And like at the high school level, when you look over the last 8 years, in six of the past 8 years, new sports opportunities for college men have increased at a rate faster than new sports opportunities for college women. And again, the same thing is happening. You're seeing a widening of the gap instead of a narrowing of the gap.
The gap is widening.
But here's the important part. Somehow, all right, so we know. Men's participation opportunities have not declined. Have men's sports teams dropped? Because you read this about this in the newspapers, right? The wrestling team has been dropped by school. Men's swimming team has been dropped by school. Sports get added and dropped all the time. So schools will drop soccer and add, lacrosse, or they'll drop wrestling and add swimming. So what you have to do is look at the net of losses and drops. And if you look at this yellow line here at the bottom, right, you can see that in Division I, the richest schools in the country, the ones with the biggest athletics programs, the biggest budgets, they are the ones that are having net losses. In Division II and Division III, net gains in terms of new men's sports. Now, that doesn't make sense, does it? That the richest schools would be dropping them and the poorest schools would be adding them.
Okay, listen here.
And you might ask why. And the answer is that in Division I, those 300 institutions are trying to compete in an arms race. They are funneling all of their money into men's football and men's basketball. And they can't cut women's sports, right? They need money to participate in this arms race. They can't cut women's sports because they'd get sued. So what are they doing? They're cutting men's minor sports. And that's why those sports teams are being dropped. Not because of Title IX, but to fuel this juggernaut in terms of the arms race. So 78% of the total athletic budgets spent on Division I men's sports in the FBS schools, which are the biggest schools in the country, 78% of men's sports budgets are spent on two sports, football and basketball.
Hello.
Right? You can see the chunk of change that's being spent on just those two sports. And who's losing? Men's minor sports. And this is another, I should have pointed this out. There are only 22 programs in the United States that bring in more money than they spend.
Out of 2,000.
There are 2,000 athletic programs in the United States. 22 are profit-making. It's a myth that, you know, all these men's sports programs or men's football and basketball are supporting women's sports. In terms of financial...
Okay, so it's a myth. The juggernaut of the arms race in those top sports, the ones we all know in the top schools, in football and basketball, they sort of, again, sort of akin to where we spend our money culturally and how much, you know, welfare, corporate welfare and sort of welfare and subsidies for big coal and big oil and big pharma and big, you know, the medical industrial complex and all of our complexes have subsidies, and all where the money is not needed is where we subsidize, and where our culture and the individuals that comprise it, because in fact we would be doing much better. It's Keynesian economics 101, that if there were more demand, more people had money to spend, all the ships would rise, not because of this nonsense lie, which is clear, the so-called trickle-down. Never in the history of any civilization has any country or people sort of starve their way to prosperity through austerity. Never happened. But we refuse to spend money on ourselves, our culture, our infrastructure, or our young girls and women. And then she just goes on. It's fascinating. You could easily find this on YouTube, Perspectives on Gender and Sports in the New Millennium. And again, this is Donna Lopiano, goes on to explain how the numbers of women in positions of authority within sports, sports editors, coaches, etc., that make the decision, is the lowest in any industry, single digits. So therefore, then, you know, the women just sort of can't actually break through, because the power jobs, the power people in sports, in every facet of sports, from, you know, high school to college to professional sports, is dominated in the positions of authority exclusively by men. And for people of color, it's much worse. And for women of color, forget it. All of those indicia of representation were in the single digits for women of color when, you know, where it has to do with sports management or editors or any decision-making position of authority. So that is one of the main, that is a main challenge, and I hope that that's, you know, basically that is the answer to the myth of somehow there's a, it's a zero sum total game, and for every girl you put on a volleyball team, some poor male wrestler has to, you know, go take home economics. It's crazy. Now, here's where it leads into what I really wanted to talk about today. This whole next generation of Title IX, what's going on, the zeitgeist right now in our country? This meme, this hashtag, yes, all women, how did that come about? Well, we all know that Elliot Rodger, the very sick person, or I don't know that he was actually sick. I don't know what he was diagnosed with, if anything. I know he was freaking angry. I know that, like, they all have one thing in common, these sort of murdering men. And, you know, you do have 12 women a day in the United States murdered by men. What you have in common with these types of Elliot Rodger cases is rage and anger. And it's sort of fed into by our, I mean, it's our culture. It's sort of, so it spawned, catalyzed this outrage where that's yes, all women, yes, all women. Yes, it's not all men, but yes, all women. 90% of sort of perpetrators of harassment, whether it's street harassment or sexual harassment or actual sexual abuse and sexual assault, are the repeat offenders. So, of course, it's not all men. And women know it's not all men. But it is, yes, all women. That's the point. Street harassment, the murders every day, domestic violence, date rape, gender pay disparity, sexual harassment on campus at the hands of students, at the hands of professors, pregnancy discrimination. We're the only nation in the civilized world that doesn't guarantee maternity leave. Can you imagine? Let alone paid maternity leave. We don't guarantee maternity leave to everyone still. And it's never paid unless your company wishes to pay you. So much for walking our family values talk. Hello. So a culture here that our culture sexualizes, objectifies women at every turn. You have, it's a truly, what was the name? You know, a girls gone wild culture where it's acceptable to have scantily clad children, 15-year-olds, selling beer and advertisements on the sides of mass transit buses. They're children. And a recreational sex drug such as Viagra, not only advertised on, you know, major national sporting events with these really embarrassing, pathetic, you know, commercials that are appealing just to the prurient interest of men. But Viagra is covered by your employer's health care, but now women's reproductive freedom is curtailed. I mean, it really is so sick that it can make you want to scream, which is why we're in this place right now where there is, you know, the hashtag everyday sexism. It's every day, everywhere. And again, for those of us who wish to sort of raise the game, because we know that it's all connected and will be the culture that probably we want us to be if we were all feminists, if women were in positions of power in greater numbers. Not that there aren't crazy women. Obviously, we have, you know, Michelle Bachmann. We've got Ann Coulter. I don't want Ann Coulter to be the president of the United States, or Sarah Palin. We understand that. But as a general rule, you know, those are the outliers and, you know, the crazy folks. There, if we made it easier, if we supported women, and it starts. So back to my back on campus, the big gun for one in four women sexually abused by the time they're 19. One in seven men, I believe, but one in four women, and the one in seven men included a higher proportion of LGBTQ folk. But one in four women. Now, if one in four women, instead of being sexually assaulted, were contracting HIV and getting AIDS, let's say that was the statistic, it would be, holy shit. And let's say now the administration, or nationally, the White House said, we're going to, for all of these 25% of women who contract HIV, we're going to supply AZT and all kinds of AIDS cocktails for life. They're hooked up. How would that be as a remedy? Well, obviously, most of us would say, are you kidding me? The idea is not to treat someone who's already gotten AIDS. How do we prevent it in the first instance? Same issue with this big gun remedy known as Title IX when it comes to the sexual assaults on campus. Because by the time it happens, you are already down for the count and complaining to your school, which, as we know from the 60 schools, including Princeton and Harvard, that are out of compliance, schools, because they have to report now through the Clery Act and the Violence Against Women Act, when it was reauthorized, has a portion known as the SAVE Act, which puts more teeth into the Clery Act. Gene Clery was a student who was raped and murdered in 1996, and the law that requires educational institutions to report, publicly report, violent crimes. Designed so you could check to disincentivize schools from having this kind of violence and doing something about it, because otherwise you might not go to that school when you find out, and it is publicly available, this information. But the schools often tend to dissuade students from really taking it outside of the little dysfunctional family. And so you don't want to have to go to the Office for Civil Rights in the Department of Education and have them do what they do in this huge bureaucratic circumlocution. You don't want the Department of Justice to bring a lawsuit that you could eventually join, maybe, if it's so egregious, and it would have to be outrageously egregious. I mean, something like they kick you out of school as a result of a sexual assault incident usually doesn't happen. So it's not about using Title IX. It's rare money damages. It's not about that law. You don't want that. You don't want to have to hire a lawyer and go to federal court with Title IX. That's as bad as AZT. And then that, in that analogy, the idea is awareness. The idea is, and which has been happening with, and that's what, again, and I'm going to play you, we have a few minutes left, some outstanding, just a little promo from a terrific website that I understand is run by undergraduates and graduate students called Know Your Nine. And here's where everyone really needs to know, and schools need to actually alert students to their rights that have nothing to do with sports. Here's Know Your Nine, that's 1X, their promo.
Nine things to know about Title IX in 89 seconds.
One, Title IX is a landmark federal civil rights law that prohibits sex discrimination in education. Title IX is not just about sports. It also addresses sexual harassment, gender-based discrimination, and sexual violence.
Two, Title IX does not apply to female students only. Male and gender nonconforming students are protected too.
Three, schools must be proactive in ensuring that your campus is free of sex discrimination. They can't just wait for something to go wrong.
Four, schools must have an established procedure for handling complaints of sex discrimination, harassment, and violence. Five, schools must take immediate action to ensure that a survivor can continue his or her education safely.
Number six, schools may not retaliate or let someone else retaliate against a victim filing a complaint.
Seven, schools can issue a no-contact directive to prevent the accused student from interacting with you, kind of like a restraining order from your school.
8. In cases of sexual violence, schools are prohibited from encouraging or allowing informal mediation of the complaint rather than a formal hearing.
9. Schools cannot discourage you from your continuing education since you have a right to education under Title IX.
You have a right to remain on campus and have every educational program and opportunity available to you.
If your rights aren't being respected, you have options. Visit knowyour9.org and check us out on Facebook and Twitter.
KnowYour9.org. Outstanding work, outstanding website. And this is the really the point. Title IX, not about you getting on the volleyball team anymore, although that's all part of it. And because you could not probably hear some of that, they were speaking so fast, let me give it to you again very quickly. And this is just an abbreviated version of the basics of Title IX as it relates to empowering students to stop sexual violence. One, Title IX is a landmark federal civil rights law that prohibits sex discrimination in education. That's what it's about, sex discrimination. And by the way, 91% of the sexual violence and sexual assault cases affect disproportionately, guess who? Women. Two, Title IX does not apply to female students only, so it is a gender-neutral law. Three, schools must be proactive in ensuring that your campus is free of sex discrimination. So you can get involved right from your freshman year because you know what? Many schools are not proactive. Many schools are not proactive. So in order, they have one Title IX compliance officer that's half asleep. And given all that's been going on in terms of, and part of it is awareness now, there's that many more reports. Title IX cases on campus have been increasing, but not because there are more assaults, but it's because there's more awareness and support and willingness for men and women to come forward and report the abuse. Four, schools must have an established procedure for handling complaints of sex discrimination, sexual harassment, or sexual violence. By the way, the difference, sexual harassment is civil. I mean, in that this, so is the Title IX is a civil law, but sex harassment is typically not physical. Sexual violence is what it sounds like in the continuum of the sort of the rape continuum, starting with sexual abuse, which typically, for instance, in New York, sexual abuse in the third degree is a misdemeanor. If someone kisses you on your cheek and you didn't consent to that, that's a crime, all the way up to rape in the first degree. Sexual and sex discrimination is anything where you as a female or as a male or as a non-conforming male or female in a gender role is being treated differently on the basis of your, you know, your sex, in fact. Five, schools must take immediate action to ensure a complainant, victim, or survivor can continue his or her education free of ongoing sex discrimination, sexual harassment, or sexual violence. Immediate action to ensure that you're not just, you know, that often when people report it, especially for women, it becomes very difficult. Are you ruining someone's life? So they tell you. There was a recent case, and I think John Stewart made fun of it a few days ago, where three sexual assault perpetrators were punished by expulsion after they graduated. That was the joke of it. And as John Stewart said, isn't that mean they graduated? They weren't expelled? Well, they're not allowed to come on campus anymore after graduation. It really is disturbing how often schools will still, without scrutiny and exposure, will try to sweep these allegations under the rug for their own PR reasons. Six, schools may not retaliate against someone filing a complaint and must keep a complainant victim safe from other retaliatory harassment or behavior. No retaliation. No retaliation against you, the survivor. No retaliation against your witnesses. No retaliation against anyone who supports you. They can't do it. It's illegal. It violates Title IX. You got to keep them on their toes with this stuff, the same way we do in our work in the workplace. You have to keep a record and make sure that they know that you know what your rights are under the law. Seven, schools can issue a no-contact directive under Title IX to prevent the accused student from approaching or interacting with you. No contact. It is like a restraining order. It's an order of protection. And they can issue it and have the authority to do so and should in cases of anything to do with sexual violence. Eight, in cases of sexual violence, schools are prohibited from encouraging or allowing mediation rather than a formal hearing of the complaint. Can you imagine schools regularly do this or used to do it and still try to get away with it where you complain that you were molested at a party and they try to mediate it where you're in the same room with your, you know, perpetrator, predator, molester, and it's almost sort of like, let's hug it out, so to speak. Now, it's completely improper, inappropriate, and if it is sexual violence, they also must get the authorities involved. If it's a crime, these are not mutually exclusive. What the campus does and what they must do to protect you and to resolve the matter and to launch some kind of corrective redress, and whether the criminal justice system believes that this is a crime, a misdemeanor, a felony that should be punished in the judicial system, the justice system. And finally, nine, schools cannot discourage you from continuing your education by saying perhaps you need some time off, happens with great frequency, or, you know, maybe now this is, you know, if you're finding it so difficult, et cetera, maybe you need to sort of go out on a sort of disability, take a sabbatical. They're not allowed to even suggest that. These are the Title IX basics. I just wanted to see in the couple of minutes that we have left, and as I mentioned, 90% of campus rapes are perpetrated by repeat offenders. So it's something to keep in mind that, again, it's not that, you know, all women are refusing to go to parties or worrying that this frat house is going to result in a sexual, you know, that you should walk around and not be able to live your life on campus. It's that the small minority of sexual predators are, in a sense, encouraged to repeat and repeat their various crimes against women because of lax enforcement, oversight, and follow-through by campuses that really don't want to report these issues. Am I out of time, Martin? Okay, this is Jack Tuckner, the Women's Rights in the Workplace Advocate, hoping you enjoyed our Title IX primer, and we'll be back next week at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.fm. Until then, have a strong and powerful week. And remember, it may be precarious, but don't give up and don't you dare give in. Jack Tuckner signing out.